Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. I am Kim Colton, your host. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. Or you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. My very, very special guest tonight and someone I consider a friend is Ronald Fino. Ronald Fino's story is something more than a Hollywood screenwriter could wish for. Crime, corruption, secret agents, gangsters, and arms dealers, all action-packed into the reality of one man's reality. From the ranks of the Buffalo, New York Mafia and corrupt unions, Ron became a FBI operative. And after 17 years of reporting on the Buffalo Mafia, his cover was blown. He then went to work undercover around the world, including Russia, the Middle East, and Belarus, performing many covert operations. He has taught at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, the CIA in McLean, Virginia, worked in Moscow, Russia, Toronto, Ontario, Washington, D.C., Las Vegas, Cleveland, Chicago, New York City, Boston, and Buffalo, New York. The account of his life in his book, The Triangle Exit, is fascinating and almost unbelievable. A tale of coming from the dark side of crime to become widely respected by law enforcement agencies and the global intelligence community, infiltrating not only the Italian mafia, but also the corruption of the Russian mafia and its stronghold in every state in the U.S. Their illegal activity runs the gamut from stolen cars, phony charities, false IDs, passports, visas, stealing state secrets, child porn, illegal arms, money laundering, narcotics, fraudulent insurance claims, medical bills, cybercrime, and on and on. The Triangle Exit is the firsthand story of one of America's most interesting covert FBI operatives, from infiltrating corrupt labor unions to Russian mafia and international arms smuggling. This story will truly fascinate anyone interested in international politics, espionage, arms smuggling, or the American, Italian, and Russian mob. Oh, welcome, Ron, to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Kim. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, my gosh. I'm telling you, that's a mouthful right there. And it's just unbelievable. Wow. Well, first of all, I want to start out with talking about MobCon 2013, which you were a guest speaker at. And how did it go this year? This was just this last weekend. And,
excellent.
Yeah?
Yes. I mean, we had people from all over coming. Of course, as you know, we had FBI agents. I was there. A couple other officers from others that worked organized crime from Las Vegas or Kansas City that dealt with the movie Casino predominantly. But beside that, we had some mafia figures from the Gambino, Colombo family from Los Angeles, and especially Chicago. So we were covering the gamut in Buffalo and from New York City to the West Coast. So it was a nice show. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just thinking, it was just fascinating that these FBI agents retired were mingling, and I do know personally that they are friends with these mob guys who, of course, have been out of the business for years and years, and they're friends with them. And
they mingle with them. They mingle with them. And one of the objectives that at least I feel, as well as the FBI officers that worked, that was that this could prove to be beneficial for those borderline organized crime figures that may cooperate with the FBI, turn informant, and provide information to help still bust the ongoing Cosa Nostra, which still exists, as well as the Russian mafia, because they're very both difficult to penetrate. And, I mean, that would be a great objective, because here we have organized crime that have tried to go straight. I'm not saying that they were good people. No, they were bad. These were killers. But because of the fact that they've testified against the organization, the Cosa Nostra and the outfit in Chicago, the government gave them a break, provided they walk the straight and narrow. And that's one of the things that we're hoping that they do, because it could prove to be a blessing for helping us destroy what's left of the Cosa Nostra, and which is still very powerful, by the way. They've just mutated, and they've changed. Now, instead of being on the streets talking, they don't do that anymore. They're always at a lawyer's office, or they'll go to a kind of showroom. Yeah, and they set up, they've always contributed to charities and creating a public image. Of course, their PR people are as important as their attorneys. They're creating an image of being a good citizen, which is a formidable defense for the FBI and other law enforcement.
Exactly. And another thing that this brings about in my head with the mob con and that, to show how these men have changed, and women, but how these men have changed, and the mafia guys, and
yes,
how their lives are so much better. And I think the majority, anyways, let me say, who are in the mafia right now are probably experiencing some of the things that these guys that were at the mob conference experienced, and wonder, what the heck do I do? Well,
here's
an example. Let's be an example to the younger folks who, and you got to think to yourself too, this is all they've ever known. When you get into the mafia, it's because your dad and your uncle and your grandpa. I mean, it's just a learned behavior. Like anybody who comes from a family of firefighters, they want to be a firefighter.
Right.
You know, it's not any different. But then when they realize what the life is really like, then it's not so rosy anymore. And thank God for people like the Frank Calabrese and Andrew DiDonato and Frank Collada who were at the MobCon. Thank God for them to tell their story and say, get out now while you can, because this is. So I think it's a wonderful thing. It's not a negative thing.
No. There's a segment of the public that believes here we're rewarding killers, like the case of Gravano, who stayed bad, by the way. You know, the success rate has not been as great as we would like it. But there's that segment that, why reward these people? Well, if you understood the Cosa Nostra, it's so difficult to penetrate, and the crimes they're committing against humanity have to stop. They have to stop. From political corruption on down the line. I mean, you could name it, they're doing it. Kiddie porn, things of that nature. So we have to stop it. And, legitimate people to come forth, it's difficult because, first of all, the mob's very secretive. So they're not in tune with what's happening. And it's not like the movies, believe me.
Mm-mm.
Or the Sopranos, because I testified in the John Ruby case, and supposedly they based the Sopranos on him and the DiCavacasso family.
I didn't know that. What were the names again? Yeah,
John Riggi. He was the boss. And I knew Johnny quite well. And to be honest, he was a very quiet, humble man. Some of them are very, very nice. Tony Accardo from Chicago was always a very nice gentleman. Lecavelli from Cleveland. That's not saying they're good people, because they're involved in killing. They're involved in destroying families. And the public does, you know, is enthralled with the Godfather and movies like that, but they don't realize that they're losing money. And I'm not just talking about having to hire FBI agents. They're into everything. And you pay for it down the line.
Gosh, Ron, I always wondered if the Sopranos was a takeoff of somebody else. I didn't know that.
Yeah. In fact, a couple of the screenwriters have contacted me. They're trying to start up a new program, and they wanted some advice in different areas. But that was based on the New Jersey film, loosely based, I have to say, because in a lot of ways, you know, even though I've never watched it, I've talked to people about it, and they tell me that it's that real.
Loosely based on these people.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Oh, my gosh. I didn't know that. I always wondered that.
Yeah.
Joe, let's talk about your dad. Let's talk about Joe Fino.
He was the boss. He was the boss of the Buffalo family for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And
well, like growing up, I'll tell you this. Well, growing up, I didn't know my
dad.
He was in jail. I don't know. I said that before on the other show.
Right.
And he was in what we used to refer to as the Army Fort. You know, as a child, I thought he was in the Army. That's what my mother would tell me. And once when we went out there visiting him, we go out there and I see this Danny Sanzanese, an associate of my father, was also a big guy. He's in the garden, and I said to my mother, "Hey, Uncle Dan's in the Army too." So he was always gone. And it was actually the manager of Joe Louis, the boxer, that raised me. He was a black man, and he treated me like a king.
Joe Louis?
Yes.
My gosh.
And so I got to know the boxing industry as well, and the rigging, and you know how they would rig, and Carpo in New York, and all those people, how the fights would get rigged.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big business. That was an easy one to rig because it was one-on-one. Racetracks and horses, even though they would get to some of the jockeys, was difficult because there were so many horses.
Right, right. You couldn't get to everybody. Boxing was one-on-one. Yeah.
Right.
So tell me about your uncle who, and the struggle you had when your dad was in the quote unquote army. This part of the book kills me.
Yeah.
We
were on welfare, but of course as a child, I didn't know what, I knew that snow was taller and everything seemed to be bigger to me. But as far as poverty, I figured everybody was on poverty. Because that was the only life I knew. We didn't realize that the heads at that time, or the underboss, and a lot of the crew left money for my family, for my mother to take care of myself and my sister.
Mm-hmm.
You there? Okay. And
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
They gave it to my uncle, my father's brother. Well, he never gave us anything. The money disappeared. Later on, just even after I wrote the book, I found out he bought a taxi and used the rest of the money because he was running the numbers. He was in the numbers, even though he had a taxi, he's using that as the front. But we didn't know, and of course, he wanted to kill him when they found out. And how they found out, Marshall Miles came to our house. And my mother used to shovel snow with whatever we could to make a couple nickels or dimes so we could get a can of soup or whatever we ate.
Right, and you would masquerade her as your brother.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, one time...
nobody would know it was your mom.
Yeah, nice lady, because I'd go to the door and ask if you want your driveway and your walkway shoveled. This lady felt sorry for me and my elder brother, who was out in front, and she started shoveling with us. I says, "Oh, no, that's all right, madam. You know, my brother and I could take care of it." She says, no, I want to help. And the next thing I know, I'm out there yelling, "George, stay out in front." I didn't want her to see that as my mother.
Right.
But we were poor. We were poor. One thing I hated was oleo. Back in those days, government would hand out this lard that had a red dot in the middle, and you'd have to squeeze it all around to give it color. Oh, that, to this day, I won't eat margarine. No, it was hard. But of course, then my father heard about it, and regarding my uncle, and he told, you know, he said, "Don't do anything, don't do anything." But he never forgave him, of course.
Eventually, your father's other friends found out that you were.
Yes,
I don't. They didn't have shoes, and
Right.
They found out, and they came through for you guys, finally.
Well, what they did, the final. Oh, I mean, to do something like that to your own brother, I mean, you know, they were very close for a lot of years. My father always took care of them. And, you know, here we were. Like you said, I had no shoes. And, you know, when Marshall Miles seen that, he says, Arlene, where's the kid's shoes? And then she explained it to him, and, of course, then they started helping us out directly. But they wanted to kill my uncle, and my father said, no, don't do that. But he never, like I said, he never forgave him. And finally he came home, and the world changed. And now I would go on weekends with him to make the rounds. And what that was to stop for coffee with one group of wise guys at one restaurant. Then we'd go to another, meet some more wise guys. And later on we'd go to the bookmaking operations. Because my father was a bookmaker, so we would go in and they'd hit the barricades and the flash paper and whatever you needed. And a bunch of these guys walk around in their shorts. And
my gosh.
Yeah, but of course, then one time I seen the police come over, and I was a little afraid because it was illegal. But they were on the tape, too, so it was never a problem.
Oh. And Ron,
I don't know.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I never liked the mob. I think,
no, I know. I just wonder.
I don't know what it was he disliked. I don't know if it was because of my mother, because my mother was strict German. You know, she, I used to call, she was an old, not an old crowd, she was my mother, and I loved her. But, she, you know, her father was like a Nazi. I mean, he was strict, my grandfather. He was a strict man. And right down the line, we couldn't get food from the fruit bin and even coal. I used to have to bring coal home. We couldn't afford coal back then. I mean, I'm 67, so I'm going back to the 50s when we had the coal chutes and the coal bins in the basement. But, but I was good at And one of the fortunate things I had, I don't know why, but I always seemed to be the teacher's pet. The teachers liked me very much. And I noticed one teacher, I wasn't doing good in arithmetic. She would stay after class and help me and until I ended up getting it. And that seemed how it worked throughout grammar school. And I went to a high school where it was a Catholic high school where the kids were great. I mean, they came from a working class, and now I was not abused in any way. Your father's a mobster or anything. They all we treated each other equally, and to this day, we're all close. So I had a great education, and that's where they also. I mean, I've educated myself.
You're kind of breaking up, Ron. You're kind of breaking up.
Hello.
Oh, there you go. You're back.
All right. Sorry about that. I know. And I'm going to sell them out in Los Angeles now. And I have to go back. Yeah, my son's out here, so I had to see him. And they don't have a phone in the room, so unfortunately I'm on my cell phone, so I'm hoping it's coming through okay.
It is.
But,
it is now. It's great. It's great, huh?
So after high school, I went to school. I went to various colleges back and forth. It took a lot of years for me to finally complete my education, but I kept going back and forth. And finally, my father was the boss, and as a result for the summer work, I was put in the Laborers International Union in Buffalo, Local 210.
Yep.
And, I mean, I worked hard at first. I mean, you name it, with the jackhammers, and I had to work. But now, all of a sudden, they wanted to make me union stewards. They make me a union steward, give me more prominence. And so I started moving up in the world. Now, Victor Indacci, who was the secretary treasurer of the union, who really controlled the laborers, thought it'd be a good idea to bring me in as a business agent so he could ingratiate himself with my father, which he did, and I became a business agent. But the only problem I had is I couldn't do anything. Anything I had to do had to be approved. Nothing. I mean, they would just tell me, take a ride and get lost. In other words, they were trying to give me a paycheck, but they didn't want me involved. I would drive on the jobs, and I'd see the workers, and I also noticed who worked, who got the good jobs, who got the bad ones. And, I mean, it was terrible. I mean, it was really terrible.
So,
if you were not connected,
you saw the corruption up close.
Yes.
And that's when you decided to run.
Yeah, and I could see which contractors were favored, the, you know, legitimate contractors that had no connections. you know, he would go down, and they would use the unions, the laborers, the Teamsters, some other unions to bring that guy down so that their favorite contractors would get the job. And it was terrible. So eventually I decided to run for office.
Excellent.
And my father
goes... And
you
wanted to clean up. You wanted to clean up the union, and you had a very successful, overly successful election.
Yes. What happened was my father was no longer the boss, and Victor changed his attitude, and he wanted me out, and I didn't, you know, I said, I'm going to run against you. And, of course, the mob didn't want that. They, you know, at that time, Sammy Frenchmore was the boss, and he said no. Well, my father said, Ronnie, you can't run. I said, I'm going to run. He said, you're going to get killed. I'm going to run anyway. So and I had a lot of support from the black community, the American Indian community, disenfranchised Italians, many Polish and Irish. So I had a lot of support, which I knew. I knew just because they were so disenchanted with what was taking place. And so what my father did, which to me was the biggest mistake, he decided, okay, I'm going to let you run, but we're going to have to bring some other Cosa Nostra people into this for you to have a chance. Otherwise, you're going to be getting killed. And, of course, he knew the mob at that time anyway, better than me.
Ew. Yeah.
So he brought on Danny Sanzanese and his John Camilleri and a few others. And in the meantime, I had to make commitments that they'd be getting prominent positions in the union if I won. The one thing we argued over that, I said, the only thing is they agreed that I could clean up the union. They said you can clean it up and change things. And when we did have the election, like you said, we won overwhelmingly. And we were in. Well, I had power for a few months, so I can't recall the exact, but it wasn't much. When I was sat down by Rosario Carlisi, who his brother later became the head of the outfit in Chicago. And Roy was a very powerful man. And he told me, from now on, you're going to have to listen to us, period. You're not to do anything. And I defied him. He stood up. He says, "Who the so-and-so words? You think you are? I mean, this guy was tough. Who do you think you are, Ronnie? How dare you?
Right.
You know, you sit down and you better listen.
Yeah. And then found out that the power didn't lie with the union.
Right.
The power.
Well I knew. No, I knew that already. The power lay with the Cosa Nostra. I knew that before. But here I was promised I'd be able to clean it up. And that showed me how little power my father had at that time, because here he comes taking a pounding from these guys, and he's not even allowed to attend the meetings, the sit-downs. So, but before this, so the public knows, I did some work with the CIA. This was going back to one of their satellite offices, watching information from Canada. They were watching some IRA people working with students getting hired to the Irish Republican Army via Canada, and all the documents were stolen, or quite a few of them were stolen, and we had an idea who did it, and I happened to know the person, and that's why I was recruited. Of course, I wasn't able to get the documents back because this guy was totally incoherent. He was so drugged up and out of it, I couldn't believe it. I mean, he seen trees chasing him. Honest to God, he's seen a tree.
Wow.
That's a tree. But it's been chasing him. So he was totally incoherent. He belonged to the psychiatric center. So I was never able to get that. But it created a relationship. Now, going back up to the current date that we were at, I was playing tennis with a friend of mine, and someone from across the from another court walked over and says, "Hey, Ron, this is Ron from the FBI," and I didn't know him. Really tall guy, 6'6", 6'7".
Wow.
And I was 6 foot. I'm shrunk a little bit. I'm about 5'7" now. But he came over, and it wasn't him saying it; it was me. I started chastising him for the FBI not doing enough to help people like this, because I'm watching the rape of people.
Right.
These are innocent people, and it really bothered me to watch these people, you know, get beat up, not just about, I'm not talking physically, but on their paycheck, et cetera. And he says, "Well, Ron, if you could help us, you know, we'd be more than happy to do something." And I said, "Well, I'll help as long as it doesn't bother my family." And I agreed to help. So that's how it started. We started a relationship.
Yeah. And then after, well, after, just looking at my notes here, sorry, your cover was blown. How did that happen?
Well, that's later on. What happened is, I was providing information on many, many different things because not only did I get close to what was in Buffalo, because of my position and what the map thought my capabilities were, they wanted me to start moving up the ladder. I would be in Cleveland with Lecca Valley, Tony Accardo in Chicago. I ended up getting to know all the mobsters out there. Vinny Solano from Chicago was very dear to me. He was a nice guy, even though he was a mobster. And the Gambinos, the Genoveses, you'd go on and on. Probably the limited, the one family I didn't have much dealing with was Philadelphia. But Johnny Riggy in New Jersey, New England, I knew everybody up there. And so it was the country. Las Vegas, you know, knew everybody. Of course, Las Vegas usually came under Chicago, the outfit.
Yeah, right.
That was under that. So I got to know them. Then my cover, how that happened, we don't know what happened, except that I complained bitterly when somebody was going to be appointed as a U.S. attorney because I learned from the mob that this was their guy. And it
what
bothered
do you mean,
me very,
somebody?
Very much. Huh?
What do you mean, somebody? Somebody was going
somebody
to be appointed?
What? Well, this person, I should say.
I'm kind of looking
going
for
to be
a name here.
Okay, Dennis Fossil. Dennis Fossil was appointed. And I knew I had problems. And I complained to the FBI bitterly that we better try to do something to stop this guy. And there was nothing they could do.
Right.
And the unfortunate thing is he was going to become aware that here I am working and with the Bureau. I could not afford. Well, what happened is they found out somehow that I've been cooperating. Now, it could have been something as subtle as just be careful of Ronnie, that he may have dropped or told somebody to drop. It was a strange coincidence after all these years that I have to be coughed up right after this guy gets in. So then he claimed he got a letter in the mail that was pointing out that I was in trouble. That's a bunch of garbage. I mean, you know, no one's going to do something like that unless you're going to do it yourself. And so I had to surface. And, of course, it came as a shock to the mobsters, not only there but around the country, that I was working all these years for the FBI. The FBI was always
not
good
a good thing.
Me. Always. Yeah. Immediately, because early on I refused to take money when I was making money on the union. I refused, but immediately right after that I went under contract. And they put me under a personal services agreement and with various names. We don't normally use our name when we sign contracts. I'm one of those people, I think I've used 20 names in my life. And so I started work with them. And at first it was on the labors of what I know, because now I'm public, I'm going to have to testify. Which I did. I mean, I testified in the Riggy case. I testified in Detroit against Jack Topol and that crew. I testified in Las Vegas, and Albany, Binghamton, New York. I go out of that. I was all over the place, Cleveland. I was really involved in going around. And it came to the point that I also became, at that time, I was also assigned as an instructor to the FBI Academy. I became an instructor initially.
That is
organized
so fantastic.
Press.
Yeah,
I taught at the academy. I taught on organized crime, but then I went into infiltrate, how to properly do undercover work, and court preparation as well. I did that too. And language classes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You taught.
You taught
the FBI Academy, the CIA. You worked in Moscow, Toronto, Ontario, Washington, D.C., Las Vegas, Cleveland, Chicago, New York. It's fascinating.
A few more in Korea. Yeah, there's quite a few of them in there.
And what did you, I mean, you seem like a cat with nine lives.
Yeah, what happened is Jim Moody, who was the section chief of organized crime, wanted me to start working with the Stanley Nye in Eastern Europe.
What's that? I'm not familiar for
Eastern
our listeners.
Europe?
No, for Eastern the
Europe.
Stanley.
Oh, Stanley and I was a supervisor that was being shifted over to Eastern Europe. And
he wanted me to
work with him. He was an FBI agent. And Stan and I were very good friends. So I started work in Eastern Europe, and I was on some of my own things. We got a liquor business, but then we eventually found out that was all corrupt. And I ended up actually getting very close to the Russian government, to the Putin administration, and a number of his advisors, his speechwriter and everything. I'd been in his office. And this was regarding the vodka, how it was stolen from the Russians by Boris Berezovsky and his courts and shipped to, and they wanted it back. And so Boris Berezovsky, by the way, and I never did get along. That's the guy that recently hung himself. He chased me all over London once. So I put that in the book. But getting into finding out.
Ron,
yes.
Ron, you're kind of breaking up again a little bit.
How's this? Am I okay?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. And I started getting close to them, and I got close to Gennady Troshev, who was the general, the commander of the Chechen army, quite a few people, Alexander Orlov, the deputy foreign minister, and I also got close to the Lukashenko administration in Belarus, and the ambassadors to the United States from both countries were very close to me. In fact, Larry Septalo, who was the ambassador to the United States for Belarus, is still a dear friend, and we're in touch all the time, and a very intelligent man. And so I did develop relationships, and I was always told not to, you know, keep your eyes open and not to go after Russia for other purposes. My job was organized crime. The reason for that was we had treaties with the Russians, and the Bureau and the CIA did not want me violating those treaties, which I never did. We had to honor our treaties. And it eventually led me into arms smuggling, where I'd been in the arms smugglers' homes. And what I would do is, in that case, I'd be allowed to do what I wanted. And I would find the corporation stream, the various corporations that they operated under, which is a myriad of corporations, so that we could have those records, which I did. And also, I got involved with a group called Hezbollah Lancer, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, one of their people. And, it was the PLO that introduced me. There's things I still can't mention, but this Michael, I will use his name, that name, introduced me. And he was really a nice guy. He was the PLO representative for many years over there. And he couldn't stand Al-Qaeda. And so he introduced me. And the guy was a bizarre individual. They wanted to make me a Muslim. And, of course, the Bureau would never allow that. It would have been an insult to the Muslim people. But I did learn quite a lot about the assassination of Harari, the connections that they had, the arms smuggling, how they're getting the arms from the Russian mafia. And I even was ready to buy two, which was never approved. They wouldn't approve it, the Bureau. I was ready to buy two T-72 tanks, very cheaply, by the way. And these were legitimate people, you know, because the people I knew would have, you know, killed them if they didn't go through with it. And they didn't know that I was going to have Israel on the other end. It was going to be, it is. I'm saying we're buying them for Nepal, and in reality, we're in Israel.
How did you keep your cool under all this?
Even in the Bureau, they would ask me that. You know, it's like, especially when the fear factor comes in. I always said, you don't have time for fear. Later on, you may shake, but when you're going through something, and any soldier will tell you that's in combat, basically the same thing. You don't have time. You're thinking too much on what you're doing next. And you know, I mean, in the movies you see that some soldiers they panic and that. No, it's not that. They're thinking too much. And later on they shake, like anybody. And one time I was being, a guy wanted to frisk me, and here I had a little Panasonic recorder in a pack of cigarettes, a Parliament cigarette.
Oh.
And, you know, we ended up getting into an argument. And I said, shame on you. How dare you even insult me like that? Now, that was when the jig was going up, and I knew something was wrong. And then he says, well, out of respect for your father, I won't do it. And that part of the tape came out quite clear. There's no cavalry coming over the hill. You're not going to be rescued. There's no FBI that's going to back you up. It doesn't happen that way. And you're on your own. You're always on your own. And one agent that I eventually went to work with, which I can't name because it was an ongoing matter, thought that I act too much as a rogue elephant. And he said that. I explained it to him because I don't want anybody tripping me up.
Right.
I don't want to get messed up. Because when you're out there, you're on your own. And if somebody's a little less, I mean, sure, you used other operatives or agents or officers at different times. But when you're actually getting the information, if you start introducing people and they slip up a little, it's going to slip you up, especially if you made the introduction. So I preferred working alone. And also, because if I did something, then I did. But no, it was very difficult for me to operate with anybody in the so-called world of the clouds. But I did get involved in a spy swap. A good friend of mine, CIA, the spy swap with Russia, Chapman, them. I was involved in that. What happened? A good friend of mine was a CIA case officer. Was after a KGB officer that was assigned to the United States by the name of Gennady Vasilenko. Well, Gennady Vasilenko was also after my friend to try to flip each other. Well, they became good friends through all this and drinking partners. They were good buddies. Well, when Hansen, the FBI agent, went south on us, he coughed up Gennady, saying that Gennady was cooperating with the CIA, which in fact was not true. He did not cooperate. Well, they finally arrested him and sent him back to Russia. Well, he was sent back to Russia, to Moscow. They called him and they charged him with having 500 rounds of .22 ammunition on him. And he was doing a hard time. So I was asked to go over there, use my connections to see if I could help get him out. And we did. We ended up I met with the deputy foreign minister, and I told him the truth. This guy's not working for us. And I told him, if you could do me the favor and believe me, just get him out of where he's doing hard time, and let's see if we get these charges reduced, because he was not working with us. And what they did is they shipped him to a community that was really nice. I mean, not that jail's ever nice, but it was where he could walk around, make his own hours, do his outside cooking. And he ended up getting caught with a cell phone.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that. So I had to go back. Now he's back in hard time. I had to go back, and this time the Russians wouldn't even talk to me. We were going through some bad times at that time here, and they refused to talk to me. So Gennady was doing that terrible bit. When the spy swap came down, we included Gennady and his family, so he's here successfully got limited to the D.C. area. So we're glad of that. This guy really was a Russian hero, and they didn't even realize it themselves. But that's the world of paranoia. At least they have a saying in the business,
right.
If you're not paranoid, there's something wrong with you.
Right.
And that's the truth. I mean, people don't know. They see movies. They see these movies and they think that it's such a fascinating life. Well, sure, because the fear factor makes great fascination. But you don't have all these toys and bells and whistles and tuxedos and enough money even to live on, let alone live that kind of life. I would have to equate it. If I had to equate it to an author, it would have to be John le Carré. He's probably more correct than anybody that I know. Don't get me wrong.
I know that author. Yeah. What are you referencing? I mean, I just think he's just fantastic.
Yeah, well, he's more realistic when he wrote about George Smiley. It's more realistic than just what you go through and the names. You're always using so many different names. And ironically, I would do that more here than I did overseas. Usually overseas, I had a code. One thing I can tell you that it's in the book, I was called Gorky, G-O-R-K-Y. So I was codenamed Gorky, but I was working overseas.
Gorky Park.
I mean, I would use different names, different identities, and different social security numbers. It wasn't just for protection, but to protect all of us from piercing eyes and attorneys trying to get at 302s. You know, those are FBI statements. So I would sign under various names to protect it because we had no choice. Now, when it comes to spying, one thing I can say to the public, we don't need to spy on everybody. That was wrong. You know, with the spy and implement to try to catch the terrorists, we had a good system in place called single thread or slender thread that really worked great. And we didn't need this expensive system that is all encompassing. And plus, it doesn't work properly anyway, I can tell you. It doesn't really work that good. And there's just too much you have to separate the wheat from the chaff, and it's not that easy. And the more you bring in, it becomes that more difficult. I don't believe what this guy did. He should, the Snowden, going to China, then to Russia, to leak our secrets, and then Russia says we're not interested. They knew what this man had on him within 2 hours. I guarantee you. They went through everything he had in his suitcase in his pockets. These are sharp individuals. They know what they're doing. And they're really well educated. Mm. But you don't do things like that. I mean, you don't turn on them because you're turning on your own people. What he should have done is he could have gone to a disgruntled senator or congressman and made a presentation.
Mm-hmm. Then
he could be accepted. But anybody that accepts
that,
I just can't understand it. He may have had good intentions, but he sure went the wrong way.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I don't believe in that either. Go ahead.
No. Well, I just have to ask you, we were talking before about like how the movies or television portray things. And whenever the movies portray the Russian mafia, it's always so intense. It's just so over the top.
Yeah.
How did you find the Russian mafia different from the mafia in the USA? I mean, is there a difference? Are they ruthless?
Yes. They're a loosely based organization, and you can kill cops very easily, but they're also very well educated. These are educated people, so they know how to. The Cosa Nostra didn't have, even though the kids of today do. That's why the Cosa Nostra is mutated, and they're more sophisticated and very more difficult to get at. But the Russian mafia already had that. And the other problem is that with the Russian mafia, they're very intelligent, highly, highly intelligent. I mean, they're into everything. And I know there was a kiddie porn case. Terrible. Huh? I mean, it's when you hear these things. It was called Operation Red Pig, and one of the guys was out of Belarus, and the other guy was, they were both out of Belarus. And it was arranged to have them go to London and various places where they were picked up and eventually shipped to Newark and tried, and they're doing hard time. But it's hard. It's like slavery. The women sold, they're behind everything. I mean, it's a big thing. It happens in the United States. There are places in Chicago they have slavery all over.
Mm-hmm.
All over. I wouldn't be surprised out here. Many of these girls, when you go to Bosco, you go to certain clubs, these beautiful young girls are all over you. And they're prostitutes. They're looking for money, which is unfortunate. And Bosco's become a two-class society. They're the rich and the poor. And it's actually going to hurt Russia because Russia became very capitalistic. And one time I was in Russia meeting with the Russian mafia people, and we had a military escort.
You had a military
military escort. We had the military vehicles behind us and in front of us. And these are mafia people. Now, I'm sure Putin deep down inside don't like the mafia like a lot of other people. But how do you get rid of them? And in America, as long as it takes money to get into elected office, as long as that's the system, we're going to have corruption. You can't help it. It's impossible to we either have to live with it, unfortunately, or find how we can better deal with it. Because with too many politicians, there's just too much corruption. I remember I was talking to Dennis Gomes, who was out in Las Vegas, and he told me about the corruption even in his office that he had. He was at the gaming industry.
Oh, my gosh. It's everywhere.
I mean, it's everywhere. And we see it. I mean, Illinois, if you're not connected in one way or another, you don't get elected. Well, that's very true in Western New York. The guy I was talking about, the U.S. attorney, became attorney general for the state. And his first job was to fire Ronald Goldstock, who was the head of the organized crime division. He did away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was terrible.
I don't know which is more corrupt, Chicago, Illinois, or Louisiana. I don't know.
It's everywhere today. It may be less in the middle part of the country, the fruit belt,
some
of the western states than it is on the East Coast, Illinois, Indiana, and all those other states. It's definitely a lot of corruption. Wisconsin, Minnesota. But there's a lot of corruption. It's unfortunate. I must say, it probably does exist in every state. But that
it
to the degree, that's to the degree, like I said, in that, you know, Kansas, and even though the Chicago outfit had Kansas, Colorado, and those states. Ironically, the Chicago outfit was not the Cosa Nostra. People think of them that way. They weren't even the mafia. No, they're not.
What?
They're none of that. Yeah, they don't even call themselves made that. Yeah. Yeah. Al Capone wasn't.
Go ahead, Al Capone.
Al Capone was nothing with that. He wasn't Sicilian. I mean, some areas, each one has its own rules. But Chicago, like Tony Accardo and that, he's the one that coined the name The Outfit. And usually how it works, and I was just talking to Tony Montana, so I got a good lesson from Tony, who really knew the Chicago family. He knows a lot better than me, so I'm you know, paraphrasing probably a few words that he said to me. And it works a lot different. Even though I knew a lot of the people in Chicago, it wasn't the Cosa Nostra. Cosa Nostra was started with New York City, and it controlled Cleveland, Buffalo. To this day, I don't know. Tony told me Detroit came under Chicago. I don't know if that's true or not, but Tony would know better than me. But I knew Jack Tocco and them, and they were close to Buffalo. For years, Buffalo was the Genovese family, and then when Joe Todaro came in, it was aligned with the Gambino family. Cleveland's always been Genovese. Pittsburgh's been Genovese. Philly has always been tied.
No, go ahead. Please continue.
So, I mean, there's always connections. And ironically, the names, the Genovese, Gambino, Colombo, Bonanno, the Cavalcanti family was not coined by the mob. They were coined by the FBI.
Wow.
People don't know that. Yeah, because they would never do that. They would never do that. So when these names came up, so they were the ones. The only one that the FBI did not do was the outfit in Chicago. Buffalo was called the Arm, but they were Cosa Nostra Buffalo. Buffalo was Cosa Nostra. There was someone, you know, they eased up on the laws a lot, because I know Johnny and Joey Pieri were made guys, and their father was a big boss. Their mother was Polish. So they were allowed to join. So there was different rules in different cities. When they brought new people in, they called it opening the books.
Opening the books.
Yeah.
So that they could allow new members.
New people. Yeah. That's what they would bring in, because they were very restrictive on who they could bring in. And either it was a relative or somebody that was a good earner or did a deed. So you'd really have to prove yourself to become a member. And sometimes it was just somebody that was close to one of the capos or one of the other people or a relative. Because they wanted me to be made. The Bureau wanted me to jump at it, but there was no chance. Why would that do that?
Because to be made, you'd have to...
Yeah, then you have to kill in that. And the Bureau, would, not that I would have to kill, but it would have given me another in its sight, because even though eventually I would have to kill, it may not take place for a while, so the Bureau feels, the Bureau, of course, would never allow that. It would never allow somebody to be hired.
Never.
In fact, one time I had a smuggling ring, people ring ready to open up, or I was going to start smuggling in some people from overseas that were involved in crime, and I can't go too deeply into it. But the Bureau killed it because they felt that if we ever lose them, then we have a problem. They get loose at us, and we don't continue to follow them, we're going to have a problem, so we can be criticized. And the Bureau, of course, is always worried about its image. And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's
agents
nothing
are
wrong
always
with
reluctant.
That. They should
no,
be.
No, you're always. Yeah, I mean, the Bureau was great up until Louis Freeh. I mean, we didn't like Sessions. Sessions was a terrible, terrible director. He was terrible. He just did not help his people. They called him Tin Session. Or they would say Alice, meaning Sessions' wife ran the Bureau. And Louis Freeh was good. He was a fighter for the people, but his hands were tagged. Because the Justice Department runs everything, and the Justice Department has the political connection. And when the last guy just came in, Mueller, though, he was not like, he gutted the street agents. He took away all the street agents and brought in people just to work on computers. And they are brilliant on computers, going after things, which is necessary. no question. But we did away with the street agent, and if you had to put them on the streets, they wouldn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a problem. And that's saying that they're not good. They are, and they're well-educated. But to go out and walk the streets and find out the human intelligence, you know, work in the human intelligence side of it, no, they're
mm-hmm.
not. So it's changed. And, I mean, it's so political today, unfortunately, everything. And, you know, today
everything.
You have to be politically correct, yeah.
Everything
you have to be politically correct, yeah. Yeah, you can't make a mistake. I mean, even, you
no.
know, with the blacks, we would call each other names. They'd call me hunky, you know, different. We didn't care. I mean, that never meant anything to us, you know, because we were friends.
I know. I remember one time I was at work, and one of the engineers said, well, we call white people, he was black, and he says, we call white people honkies. And I said, do you mean like honky-tonk? I didn't know what
yeah.
the frickin' yeah. frack he was talking about.
Oh, yeah, but we'd laugh. I mean, we were friends. I mean, these, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'd call them names. I mean, we all did those things, and we'd laugh it off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we were that close. So that
right.
was like
right.
And even the Jewish community, you know, I go over to Israel and
yeah.
I talk to them all the time. And I'll give you examples. The Jewish people, you know, they use the word Jew. I said, it's not good just to call a Jew. I don't
oh,
you know, it's
no.
a bad way of putting something. So I said, we
right.
say Jewish, you know. So but you know why?
Exactly.
But we are Jews, you know, and the same with Poland.
Right.
I'm in Poland and they would use the word Polak. They would call themselves Polak, and I would tell them, we don't use it in America. Why? It's our name.
Right. Exactly. Well, hey, Ron, I wanted to ask you about John Gotti. We yeah. kind of touched on it before, but with the Genovese, he was the Genovese family.
It was that?
Correct?
Yeah.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Oh, you're breaking up.
You got the Gambino family.
What?
Oh.
You're not walking yeah. around the room again, are you?
No. Can you hear me?
All right, let's try
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
He was Gambino.
Oh, Gambino. I'm sorry. Yes, Gambino.
Yeah, he was the
did
Gambino
have...
family.
What did you think of him? I mean, the Teflon Don, all that.
Oh, he was a buffoon.
Stuff.
He was a buffoon going out. No one liked him.
He was.
In fact, the Genovese family wanted to kill him.
Mm.
He was just a terrible, terrible. You there?
Yeah, you cut out again, but that's okay.
Are you there?
I'm there. I'm here.
Okay, sorry about that. I don't want to screw it up for the public here. But
okay.
He was a Gambino, and he was a buffoon.
Mm-hmm.
He was just terrible out there waving and wearing $1,000 suits, waving money around with that arrogant, you know, strut and smile. No, they didn't like him, the family. He did a terrible, that's why you knew he wasn't going to last. The Genovese is the traditional rule is to keep your quiet, stay out of the limelight. Because once you're in the limelight, at least back then, today it's different because they use PR firms. But back then, you're focusing, here he's saying he's the boss, you know, involved in
right.
this thing. So, you know, he wasn't
right.
well liked. His kid wasn't well liked. You know, it was a terrible time for them. And of course, we had the commission case. I ended up in the commission case.
Really?
What happened is, we had to cut the area, the geographic area for work for the business agents at Erie County and Cattaraugus County up. So the John and Joe Pieri happened to have the Indian reservations for the Seneca Nations. And what they did is we always had a rule. If we had work on the reservation or that, the American Indians would get the jobs because they lived there we had a lot of them. But the John and Joe Pieri, because they were having this squabble with the Tenaros and everything was cut up, the different areas decided, we'll put our own people there. Well, I get a call from Kelvin Lay, who was a dear friend from the Seneca Nations. He was the president. Ron, what's going on? And I told him, Kelvin, I have to meet you secretly. So we met secretly, and I told him. And I told him, here's the way you can solve it. I want you to go down to the Union Hall and scream. Don't go alone. Bring a few people. And what they did is they went down to the Union Hall and they asked for the Pieris specifically. which then, you know, obviously pointed to me, which they shouldn't have done. But they did it anyway. And they came out with three cars. One car was actually like the card top. They cut it off and made it convertible. You could see all the burn marks. But they were about 20 strong, actually, so it may have been more than three. And they waited there for the Pieris for about 4 hours. The Pieris refused to come out. I found out later that they spent the night in the building. They were so afraid. Well, Joe Pieri goes down to meet with Tony Salerno, who's one of the heads in the Genovese family, or at least the front head, you know, for show. And he meets with them. Uh-huh. He tells them that that Ron Fino, on behalf of the Tenaros, put the American Indians on his kids. So I'm down in Florida with Joe Tenaro and Louis Giordano from the Gambino family. And he asked me to go to a restaurant. And Joe Tenaro Sr. was the boss by now in the Buffalo family, if I didn't make that known before. And I'm down there with him, and he goes outside with me. Did you sick the Indians on the Pieris? And I said, yeah, I did. He said, oh, I got more problems over it, but don't worry. Don't worry. I actually liked Joe Tenaro Sr. He was a businessman, and I kind of told him his base, the most successful pizzerias in the country. Their wings and all that all over. And I was telling him in the basement, Joe, you got to get out of this. I mean, you don't need this. Yeah. You're a multimillionaire with this. He said, Ronnie, how do I get out of it? How do I get out of it? Everything I have would be lost. Someone will come in and take it all over. And he's probably correct. And he just recently died. As much as I got along with him, I didn't get along with his son. His son was more aloof and pushing himself around, and who's probably now the boss. So.
You know,
you walk the light, you do your deeds, and I've always tried to do the right thing. I mean, there was one time.
You always have.
We were offered money one time, and now I have to take it. We were offered money for a kickback on a dental plan that they had. And I had this money, I think it was about $2,000, I forget the amount, but I had this money, and I was supposed to cut it up with my father, but, you know, I can't keep that money. So I ended up going to a friend of mine, Al Hardo, who was with the Strike Force, who you read early on, was originally with the CIA, and I went to him, and I talked to him, but I turned in the money. And of course, I had to go tell my father. My father could say, you're going to get killed, Ronnie, you're going to get killed, Ronnie. But he understood that I was killed. Yeah.
Well, your book is fantastic. The Triangle Exit. I love the part about how your mom wakes you up in the middle of the night and says, stuff these coins in the cushions.
I remember that very clearly.
And
we were pushing it under the couch and everywhere. They were all quarters and 50 cent pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah, we heard my father struggling up the stairs with the money.
Yeah. So, and he was going to give it to his brother.
Yeah. Those things happen. We all have family problems, at least some of us.
We
anyway.
Do. Oh.
We have problems. You know, people are people. You know, I found
people
going around the world, one thing I did, people are people. And all we have to do is we can start treating each other with a little more respect, being honest with each other, protecting our neighbor's property.
Oh,
we could live in a much better world.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy. One of the problems I would teach at the academy is what happens if someone put a suitcase for $2 million at your feet and you knew you could get away with it and you knew you're positive, would you take it?
M.J. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
you
have a responsibility.
If I could get away with it?
Yeah, because you have a responsibility to the public. It's the little guy out there that you have to think of, the one that doesn't have the connection. The one that's out there that's counting on you, that's because you're in a position of trying to help people. So you have a fiduciary responsibility. And, you know, you don't make money in this business. You know, and I can tell you, I have a pension, which I feel pays for my mortgage, but I have to go out and do PI work to supplement it, even at my age. You know, I'm 67, but I still have to do that. But I don't mind. You know, I lived a good life. I have a good family, and I'm happy.
Yes, you do.
And I'm happy. And I just, you'd like to see a little more humanity come back into place. And education, I mean, we ruined the educational system in this country. I have a 19-year-old, and I'm telling you, he takes four subjects. He never studies it. Now, he just graduated from high school with a B average. And there's no way in my mind he's a B student. I mean, I had simple. Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate because we've lowered the standard so much, and it's you know, maybe because of a few minorities or something that thought that the standards were too high. But I can tell you, the majority of them, and I'm not just talking minorities, but the people that were undereducated, the majority of them want their children educated too, and they want the best education, and they would never be for that lowering standards. Give them extra assistance, right, like I received. You know, to bring them up, you have to instill that in the heads that education, education is the bridge to the future. And it's not what you learn in school. What you learn in school, you can put in a thimble. It's you learn how to learn. And now all of a sudden you become a sponge and everything sucks. You know, you suck everything in, you know, once you reach a certain point. But you have to start that early. We cannot under-educate our children anymore. We have to get these kids an education.
I agree, Ron. I agree.
We see it all over, all of us.
We do. We do. And we ran out of time, but that's okay because you can play it back on archives and you'll hear the rest of the show. Again, I want to, Ron, thank you so much for being here tonight. Thank you so much for sending me your book. I love it.
I'm sorry for the phone, by the way. The phone broke up.
Oh, that's okay. That's no big deal. The Triangle Exit. The Triangle Exit.
Actually, they want to know what it's based on. That's the exit for Quantico off of 95. And I would tell people, take the Triangle Exit.
The Triangle Exit is the firsthand story of one of America's most interesting covert FBI operatives. From infiltrating corrupt labor unions to Russian mafia and international arms smuggling, the story will surely fascinate anyone interested in international politics, espionage, arms smuggling, or the American, Italian, and Russian mob. And your website, Ron, is ronaldfino.com. And that's ronaldfino.com. Ron, I can't thank you enough for being here tonight. It was wonderful.
Thanks, and I hope your show becomes a success because more people should get to really hear the real news. And
Exactly. That's how I feel.
That's why it's called Blog Radio.
That's right. And it's Blog Talk. It's internet radio, and you can say what you want. And again, you know, I'm thinking it's my show, so you can say what you want. Thanks to my public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. And please join me next Tuesday at 2:30 Pacific Time and 5:30 Eastern for Robert George Allen's show, Ghosts and Gangsters, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night, Ron.
Good night, Kit. Thank you so much, Kit. And we'll get together soon.
You bet. Thank you.
All right.
Good night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.